That is more or less the way towards the place where we last saw the elf fires. It was difficult to get them to understand, what with their dizzy heads, and the shouts, and the whacking of sticks, and the throwing of stones, but at last Bilbo felt he could delay no longer. The spiders were drawing their circle ever closer. He suddenly slipped on his ring, and to the great astonishment of the dwarves he vanished. Soon there came the sound of "Lazy Lob" and "Attacop" from among the trees away on the right. That upset the spiders greatly. They stopped advancing, and some went off in the direction of the voice. Attacop made them so angry that they lost their wits. Then Balin, who had grasped Bilbo's plan better than the rest, led an attack. The dwarves huddled together in a knot, and sending a shower of stones, they drove at the spiders on the left and burst through the ring. Away behind them now, the shouting and singing suddenly stopped. Hoping desperately that Bilbo had not been caught, the dwarves went on. Not fast enough, though. They were sick and weary, and they could not go much better than a hobble and a wobble, though many of the spiders were close behind. Every now and then they had to turn and fight the creatures that were overtaking them, and already some spiders were in the trees above them and throwing down their long, clinging threads. Things were looking pretty bad again, when suddenly Bilbo appeared and charged into the astonished spiders unexpectedly from the side. "Go on! Go on!" he shouted. "I will do the stinging!" And he did. He darted backwards and forwards, slashing at spider threads, hacking at their legs, and stabbing at their fat bodies if they came too near. The spiders swelled with rage, and spluttered and frothed, and hissed out horrible curses. But they had become mortally afraid of Sting, and dared not come very near, now that it had come back. So curse as they would, their prey moved slowly but steadily away. It was a most terrible business, and seemed to take hours. But at last, just when Bilbo felt that he could not lift his hand for a single stroke more, the spider suddenly gave it up, and followed them no more, but went back disappointedly to their dark colony. The dwarves then noticed that they had come to the edge of a ring where elf fires had been. Whether it was one of those they had seen the night before, they could not tell. But it seemed that some good magic lingered in such spots, which the spiders did not like. At any rate, here the light was greener, and the boughs less thick and threatening, and they had a chance to rest and draw breath. There they lay for some time, puffing and panting, but very soon they began to ask questions. They had to have the whole vanishing business carefully explained, and the finding of the ring interested them so much that for a while they forgot their own troubles. Balin, in particular, insisted on having the Gollum story, riddles and all, told all over again, with the ring in its proper place. But after a time the light began to fail, and then other questions were asked. Where were they? And where was their path? And where was there any food? And what were they going to do next? These questions they asked over and over again, and it was from little Bilbo that they seemed to expect to get the answers, from which you can see that they had changed their opinion of Mr. Baggins very much, and had begun to have a great respect for him, as Gandalf had said they would. Indeed, they really expected him to think of some wonderful plan for helping them, and were not merely grumbling. They knew only too well that they would soon all have been dead if it had not been for the Hobbit, and they thanked him many times. Some of them even got up and bowed right to the ground before him, though they fell over with the effort, and could not get on their legs again for some time. Knowing the truth about the vanishing did not lessen their opinions of Bilbo at all, for they saw that he had some wits, as well as luck and a magic ring, and all three are very useful possessions. In fact, they praised him so much that Bilbo began to feel there really was something of a bold adventurer about himself after all, though he would have felt a lot bolder still if there had been anything to eat. But there was nothing, nothing at all, and none of them were fit to go and look for anything, or to search for the lost path. The lost path! No other idea would come into Bilbo's tired head. He just sat staring in front of him at the endless trees, and after a while they all fell silent again, all except Balin. Long after the others had stopped talking and shut their eyes, he kept on muttering and chuckling to himself.
"Gollum! Well, I'm blessed. So that's how he sneaked past me, is it? Now I know. Just crept quietly along, did you, Mr. Baggins? Buttons all over the doorstep. Good old Bilbo. 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 Bo. Bo. Bo."
And then he fell asleep, and there was complete silence for a long time. All of a sudden, Dwalin opened an eye and looked round at them.
"Where is Thorin?" he asked.
It was a terrible shock. Of course, there were only 13 of them, 12 dwarves and the hobbit. Where indeed was Thorin? They wondered what evil fate had befallen him, magic or dark monsters, and shuddered as they lay lost in the forest. There they dropped off one by one into uncomfortable sleep full of horrible dreams, as evening wore to black night. And there we must leave them for the present, too sick and weary to set guards or take turns watching. Thorin had been caught much faster than they had. You remember Bilbo falling like a log into sleep as he stepped into a circle of light? The next time it had been Thorin who stepped forward, and as the lights went out, he fell like a stone enchanted. All the noise of the dwarves lost in the night, their cries as the spiders caught them and bound them, and all the sounds of the battle next day had passed over him unheard. Then the wood elves had come to him, and bound him, and carried him away. The feasting people were wood elves, of course. These are not wicked folk. If they have a fault, it is distrust of strangers. Though their magic was strong, even in those days they were wary. They differed from the high elves of the West, and were more dangerous and less wise. For most of them, together with their scattered relations in the hills and mountains, were descended from the ancient tribes that never went to faerie in the West. There the light elves and the deep elves and the sea elves went and lived for ages, and grew fairer and wiser and more learned, and invented their magic and their cunning craft in the making of beautiful and marvellous things, before some came back into the wide world. In the wide world the wood elves lingered in the twilight of our sun and moon, but loved best the stars, and they wandered in the great forests that grew tall in lands that are now lost. They dwelt most often by the edges of the woods, from which they could escape at times to hunt, or to ride and run over the open lands by moonlight or starlight, and after the coming of men they took even more and more to the gloaming and the dusk. Still, elves they were and remain, and that is good people. In a great cave some miles within the edge of Mirkwood on its eastern side, there lived at this time their greatest king. Before his huge doors of stone, a river ran out of the heights of the forest and flowed on and out into the marshes at the feet of the high wooded lands. This great cave, from which countless smaller ones opened out on every side, wound far underground and had many passages and wide halls. But it was lighter and more wholesome than any goblin dwelling, and neither so deep nor so dangerous. In fact, the subjects of the king mostly lived and hunted in the open woods, and had houses or huts on the ground and in the branches. The beeches were their favourite trees. The king's cave was his palace, and the strong place of his treasure, and the fortress of his people against their enemies. It was also the dungeon of his prisoners. So to the cave they dragged Thorin, not too gently, for they did not love dwarves and thought he was an enemy. In ancient days they had had wars with some of the dwarves, whom they accused of stealing their treasure. It is only fair to say that the dwarves gave a different account, and said that they only took what was their due, for the elf king had bargained with them to shape his raw gold and silver, and had afterwards refused to give them their pay. If the elf king had a weakness, it was for treasure, especially for silver and white gems. And though his hoard was rich, he was ever eager for more, since he had not yet as great a treasure as other elf lords of old. His people neither mined nor worked metals or jewels, nor did they bother much with trade or with tilling the earth. All this was well known to every dwarf, though Thorin's family had had nothing to do with the old quarrel I have spoken of. Consequently, Thorin was angry at their treatment of him, when they took their spell off him and he came to his senses, and also he was determined that no word of gold or jewels should be dragged out of him. The king looked sternly at Thorin when he was brought before him and asked him many questions, but Thorin would only say that he was starving.
"Why did you and your folk 3 times try to attack my people at their merrymaking?" asked the king. "We did not attack them," answered Thorin. "We came to beg because we were starving." "Where are your friends now, and what are they doing?" "I don't know, but I expect starving in the forest." "What were you doing in the forest?" "Looking for food and drink, because we were starving." "But what brought you into the forest at all?" asked the king angrily. At that Thorin shut his mouth and would not say another word. "Very well," said the king. "Take him away and keep him safe until he feels inclined to tell the truth, even if he waits 100 years.
Then the elves put thongs on him and shut him in one of the inmost caves with strong wooden doors and left him. They gave him food and drink, plenty of both, if not very fine, for wood elves were not goblins and were reasonably well behaved even to their worst enemies when they captured them. The giant spiders were the only living things that they had no mercy upon. There in the king's dungeon poor Thorin lay, and after he had got over his thankfulness for bread and meat and water, he began to wonder what had become of his unfortunate friends. It was not very long before he discovered, but that belongs to the next chapter, and the beginning of another adventure in which the hobbit again showed his usefulness. Chapter 9. Barrels Out of Bond. The day after the battle with the spiders, Bilbo and the dwarves made one last despairing effort to find a way out before they died of hunger and thirst. They got up and staggered on in the direction which 8 of the 13 of them guessed to be the one in which the path lay, but they never found out if they were right. Such day as there ever was in the forest was fading once more into the blackness of night, when suddenly out sprang the light of many torches all round them, like hundreds of red stars. Out leapt wood elves with their bows and spears, and called the dwarves to halt. There was no thought of a fight. Even if the dwarves had not been in such a state that they were actually glad to be captured, their small knives, the only weapons they had, would have been of no use against the arrows of the elves that could hit a bird's eye in the dark. So they simply stopped dead and sat down and waited, all except Bilbo, who popped on his ring and slipped quickly to one side. That is why, when the elves bound the dwarves in a long line, one behind the other, and counted them, they never found or counted the hobbit. nor did they hear or feel him trotting along well behind their torchlight as they led off their prisoners into the forest. Each dwarf was blindfolded, but that did not make much difference, for even Bilbo, with the use of his eyes, could not see where they were going, and neither he nor the others knew where they had started from anyway. Bilbo had all he could do to keep up with the torches, for the elves were making the dwarves go as fast as ever they could, sick and weary as they were. The king had ordered them to make haste. Suddenly the torches stopped, and the hobbit had just time to catch them up before they began to cross the bridge. This was the bridge that led across the river to the king's doors. The water flowed dark and swift and strong beneath, and at the far end were gates before the mouth of a huge cave that ran into the side of a steep slope covered with trees. There the great beeches came right down to the bank till their feet were in the stream. Across this bridge the elves thrust their prisoners, but Bilbo hesitated in the rear. He did not at all like the look of the cavern mouth, and he only made up his mind not to desert his friends just in time to scuttle over at the heels of the last elves before the great gates of the king closed behind them with a clang. Inside the passages were lit with red torchlight, and the elf guards sang as they marched along the twisting, crossing, and echoing paths. These were not like those of the goblin cities. They were smaller, less deep underground, and filled with a cleaner air. In a great hall with pillars hewn out of the living stone sat the elven king on a chair of carven wood. On his head was a crown of berries and red leaves, for the autumn was come again. In the spring he wore a crown of woodland flowers. In his hand he held a carven staff of oak. The prisoners were brought before him, and though he looked grimly at them, he told his men to unbind them, for they were ragged and weary. "Besides, they need no ropes in here," said he. "There is no escape from my magic doors for those who are once brought inside." Long and searchingly he questioned the dwarves about their doings, and where they were going to, and where they were coming from, but he got little more news out of them than out of Thorin. They were surly and angry, and did not even pretend to be polite.
"What have we done, O king?" said Balin, who was the eldest left. "Is it a crime to be lost in the forest, to be hungry and thirsty, to be trapped by spiders? Are the spiders your tame beasts or your pets, if killing them makes you angry?"
Such a question, of course, made the king angrier than ever, and he answered, "It is a crime to wander in my realm without leave. Do you forget that you are in my kingdom, using the road that my people made? Did you not three times pursue and trouble my people in the forest, and rouse the spiders with your riot and clamour? After all the disturbances you have made, I have a right to know what brings you here, and if you will not tell me now, I will keep you all in prison until you have learned sense and manners." Then he ordered the dwarves each to be put in a separate cell, and to be given food and drink, but not to be allowed to pass the doors of their little prisons until one at least of them was willing to tell him all he wanted to know. But he did not tell them that Thorin was also a prisoner with him. It was Bilbo who found that out. Poor Mr. Baggins! It was a weary long time that he lived in that place all alone, and always in hiding, never daring to take off his ring, hardly daring to sleep, even tucked away in the darkest and remotest corners he could find. For something to do, he took to wandering about the Elven King's palace. Magic shut the gates, but he could sometimes get out, if he was quick. Companies of the Wood Elves, sometimes with a king at their head, would from time to time ride out to hunt, or to other business in the woods and in the lands to the east. Then, if Bilbo was very nimble, he could slip out just behind them, though it was a dangerous thing to do. More than once he was nearly caught in the doors, as they clashed together when the last elf passed. yet he did not dare to march among them, because of his shadow, altogether thin and wobbly as it was in torchlight, or for fear of being bumped into and discovered. And when he did go out, which was not very often, he did no good. He did not wish to desert the dwarves, and indeed he did not know where in the world to go without them. He could not keep up with the hunting elves all the time they were out, so he never discovered the ways out of the wood, and was left to wander miserably in the forest, terrified of losing himself, until a chance came of returning. He was hungry, too, outside, for he was no hunter, but inside the caves he could pick up a living of some sort by stealing food from store or table when no one was at hand. "I'm like a burglar that can't get away, but must go on miserably burgling the same house day after day," he thought. "This is the dreariest and dullest part of all this wretched, tiresome, uncomfortable adventure. I wish I was back in my hobbit hole by my own warm fireside with the lamp shining." He often wished, too, that he could get a message for help sent to the wizard, but that, of course, was quite impossible, and he soon realized that if anything was to be done, it would have to be done by Mr. Baggins, alone and unaided. Eventually, after a week or two of this sneaking sort of life, by watching and following the guards and taking what chances he could, he managed to find out where each dwarf was kept. He found all their 12 cells in different parts of the palace, and after a time he got to know his way about very well. What was his surprise one day to overhear some of the guards talking, and to learn that there was another dwarf in prison too, in a specially deep dark place. He guessed at once, of course, that that was Thorin, and after a while he found that his guess was right. At last, after many difficulties, he managed to find the place when no one was about, and to have a word with the chief of the dwarves. Thorin was too wretched to be angry any longer at his misfortunes, and was even beginning to think of telling the king all about his treasure and his quest, which shows how low-spirited he had become, when he heard Bilbo's little voice at his keyhole. He could hardly believe his ears. Soon, however, he made up his mind that he could not be mistaken, and he came to the door and had a long, whispered talk with the hobbit on the other side. So it was that Bilbo was able to take secretly Thorin's message to each of the other imprisoned dwarves, telling them that Thorin, their chief, was also in prison close at hand, and that no one was to reveal their errand to the king. Not yet, not before Thorin gave the word. For Thorin had taken heart again, hearing how the hobbit had rescued his companions from the spiders, and was determined once more not to ransom himself with promises to the king of a share in the treasure, until all hope of escaping in any other way had disappeared. Until, in fact, the remarkable Mr. Invisible Baggins, of whom he began to have a very high opinion indeed, had altogether failed to think of something clever. The other dwarves quite agreed when they got the message. They all thought their own shares in the treasure, which they quite regarded as theirs, in spite of their plight and the still unconquered dragon, would suffer seriously if the wood elves claimed part of it, and they all trusted Bilbo. Just what Gandalf had said would happen, you see. Perhaps that was part of his reason for going off and leaving them. Bilbo, however, did not feel nearly so hopeful as they did. He didn't like being depended on by everyone, and he wished he had the wizard at hand. But that was no use. Probably all the dark distance of Mirkwood lay between them. He sat and thought, until his head nearly burst, but no bright idea would come. One invisible ring was a very fine thing, but it was not much good among 14. But, of course, as you've guessed, he did rescue his friends in the end, and this is how it happened. One day, nosing and wandering about,
Bilbo discovered a very interesting thing. The great gates were not the only entrance to the caves. A stream flowed under part of the lowest regions of the palace and joined the forest river some way further to the east, beyond the steep slope out of which the main mouth opened. Where this underground watercourse came forth from the hillside, there was a water gate. There the rocky roof came down close to the surface of the stream, and from it a portcullis could be dropped right to the bed of the river to prevent anyone coming in or out that way. But the portcullis was often open, for a good deal of traffic went out and in by the water gate. If anyone had come in that way, he would have found himself in a dark, rough tunnel leading deep into the heart of the hill. But at one point where it passed under the caves, the roof had been cut away and covered with great oaken trapdoors. These opened upwards into the king's cellars. There stood barrels and barrels and barrels, for the wood elves, and especially their king, were very fond of wine, though no vines grew in those parts. The wine and other goods were brought from far away, from their kinsfolk in the south, or from the vineyards of men in distant lands. Hiding behind one of the largest barrels, Bilbo discovered the trapdoors and their use, and lurking there, listening to the talk of the king's servants, he learned how the wine and other goods came up the rivers, or overland, to the Long Lake. It seemed a town of men still throve there, built out on bridges far into the water as a protection against enemies of all sorts, and especially against the Dragon of the Mountain. From Lake Town, the barrels were brought up the forest river. Often they were just tied together like big rafts and poled or rowed up the stream. Sometimes they were loaded onto flat boats. When the barrels were empty, the elves cast them through the trapdoors, opened the water gate, and out the barrels floated on the stream, bobbing along, until they were carried by the current to a place far down the river where the bank jutted out, near to the very eastern edge of Mirkwood. There they were collected and tied together and floated back to Lake Town, which stood close to the point where the forest river flowed into the Long Lake. For some time, Bilbo sat and thought about this water gate, and wondered if it could be used for the escape of his friends, and at last he had the desperate beginnings of a plan. The evening meal had been taken to the prisoners. The guards were tramping away down the passages, taking the torchlight with them, and leaving everything in darkness. Then Bilbo heard the king's butler bidding the chief of the guards good night.
"Now come with me," he said, "and taste the new wine that has just come in. I shall be hard at work tonight clearing the cellars of the empty wood, so let us have a drink first to help the labour." "Very good," laughed the chief of the guards. "I'll taste with you and see if it's fit for the king's table. There's a feast tonight, and it would not do to send up poor stuff."
When he heard this, Bilbo was all in a flutter, for he saw that luck was with him, and he had a chance at once to try his desperate plan. He followed the two elves until they entered a small cellar and sat down at a table on which two large flagons were set. Soon they began to drink and laugh merrily. Luck of an unusual kind was with Bilbo then. It must be potent wine to make a wood elf drowsy, but this wine, it would seem, was the heady vintage of the great gardens of Dorwinion, not meant for his soldiers or his servants, but for the king's feasts only, and for smaller bowls, not for the butler's great flagons. Very soon the chief guard nodded his head. Then he laid it on the table and fell fast asleep. The butler went on talking and laughing to himself for a while, without seeming to notice, but soon his head, too, nodded to the table, and he fell asleep and snored beside his friend. Then in crept the hobbit. Very soon the chief guard had no keys, but Bilbo was trotting as fast as he could along the passage toward the cells. The great bunch seemed very heavy to his arms, and his heart was often in his mouth, in spite of his ring, for he could not prevent the keys from making every now and then a loud clink and clank, which put him all in a tremble. First he unlocked Balin's door, and locked it again carefully as soon as the dwarf was outside. Balin was most surprised, as you can imagine, but glad as he was to get out of his wearisome little stone room, he wanted to stop and ask questions, and know what Bilbo was going to do, and all about it.
"No time now," said the hobbit. "You must follow me. We must all keep together and not risk getting separated. All of us must escape or none, and this is our last chance. If this is found out, goodness knows where the king will put you next, with chains on your hands and feet too, I expect. Don't argue. There's a good fellow."
Then off he went from door to door, until his following had grown to 12, none of them any too nimble, what with the dark, and what with their long imprisonment. Bilbo's heart thumped every time one of them bumped into another, or grunted or whispered in the dark. "Trat this dwarvish racket," he said to himself. But all went well, and they met no guards. As a matter of fact, there was a great autumn feast in the woods that night, and in the halls above. Nearly all the king's folk were merrymaking. At last, after much blundering, they came to Thorin's dungeon, far down in a deep place, and fortunately not far from the cellars.
"Upon my word," said Thorin, when Bilbo whispered to him to come out and join his friends. "Gandalf spoke true as usual. A pretty fine burglar you make, it seems, when the time comes. I'm sure we are all for ever at your service, whatever happens after this. But what comes next?"
Bilbo saw that the time had come to explain his idea, as far as he would. But he did not feel at all sure how the dwarves would take it. His fears were quite justified, for they did not like it a bit, and started grumbling loudly in spite of their danger.
"We shall be bruised and battered to pieces, and drowned too for certain," they muttered. "We thought you had got some sensible notion when you managed to get hold of the keys. This is a mad idea."
"Very well," said Bilbo, very downcast, and also rather annoyed. "Come along back to your nice cells, and I will lock you all in again, and you can sit there comfortably and think of a better plan. But I don't suppose I shall ever get hold of the keys again, even if I feel inclined to try." That was too much for them, and they calmed down. In the end, of course, they had to do just what Bilbo suggested, because it was obviously impossible for them to try and find their way into the upper halls, or to fight their way out of gates that closed by magic, and it was no good grumbling in the passages until they were caught again. So, following the hobbit, down into the lowest cellars they crept. They passed a door through which the chief guard and the butler could be seen still happily snoring with smiles upon their faces. The wine of Dorwinion brings deep and pleasant dreams. There would be a different expression on the face of the chief guard next day, even though Bilbo, before they went on, stole in and kind-heartedly put the keys back on his belt. "That will save him some of the trouble he's in for," said Mr. Baggins to himself. "He wasn't a bad fellow, and quite decent to the prisoners. It'll puzzle them all, too. They will think we had a very strong magic to pass through all these locked doors and disappear. Disappear. We've got to get busy very quick, if that is to happen." Balin was told off to watch the guard and the butler and give warning if they stirred. The rest went into the adjoining cellar with the trapdoors. There was little time to lose. Before long, as Bilbo knew, some elves were under orders to come down and help the butler get the empty barrels through the doors into the stream. These were, in fact, already standing in rows in the middle of the floor, waiting to be pushed off. Some of them were wine barrels, and these were not much use,
as they could not easily be opened at the end without a deal of noise, nor could they easily be secured again. But among them were several others, which had been used for bringing other stuffs, butter, apples, and all sorts of things, to the king's palace. They soon found 13 with room enough for a dwarf in each. In fact, some were too roomy, and as they climbed in, the dwarves thought anxiously of the shaking and the bumping they would get inside, though Bilbo did his best to find straw and other stuff to pack them in as cosily as could be managed in a short time. At last, 12 dwarves were stowed. Thorin had given a lot of trouble, and turned and twisted in his tub and grumbled like a large dog in a small kennel, while Balin, who came last, made a great fuss about his air holes and said he was stifling, even before his lid was on. Bilbo had done what he could to close holes in the sides of the barrels, and to fix on all the lids as safely as could be managed, and now he was left alone again, running round putting the finishing touches to the packing, and hoping against hope that his plan would come off. It had not been a bit too soon. Only a minute or two after Balin's lid had been fitted on, there came the sound of voices and the flicker of lights. A number of elves came laughing and talking into the cellars and singing snatches of song. They had left a merry feast in one of the halls and were bent on returning as soon as they could.
"Where's old Galleon, the butler?" said one. "I haven't seen him at the tables tonight. He ought to be here now to show us what's to be done." "I shall be angry if the old slow coach is late," said another. "I've no wish to waste time down here while the song is up." "Ha-ha!" came a cry. "Here's the old villain with his head on a jug. He's been having a little feast all to himself and his friend the captain." "Shake him! Wake him!" shouted the others impatiently.
Galleon was not at all pleased at being shaken or wakened, and still less at being laughed at.
"You're all late," he grumbled. "Here am I, waiting and waiting down here, while you fellows drink and make merry and forget your tasks. Small wonder if I fall asleep from weariness." "Small wonder!" said they. "When the explanation stands close at hand in a jug. Come, give us a taste of your sleeping draught before we fall to. No need to wake the turnkey yonder. He's had his share by the looks of it."
Then they drank once round and became mighty merry all of a sudden. But they did not quite lose their wits.
"Save us, Galleon," cried some. "You began your feasting early and muddled your wits. You've stacked some full casks here instead of the empty one, if there's anything in weight." "Get on with the work," growled the butler. "There is nothing in the feeling of weight in an idle tosspot's arms. These are the ones to go and no others. Do as I say." "Very well, very well," they answered, rolling the barrels to the opening. "On your head be it, if the king's full butter tubs and his best wine is pushed into the river for the lake men to feast on for nothing."
Roll, 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 rolling down the hole. Heave, ho, splash, plump, down they go, down they bump.
So they sang as first one barrel and then another rumbled to the dark opening and was pushed over into the cold water some feet below. Some were barrels really empty, some were tubs neatly packed with a dwarf each, but down they all went, one after another, with many a clash and a bump, thudding on top of ones below, smacking into the water, jostling against the walls of the tunnel, knocking into one another, and bobbing away down the current. It was just at this moment that Bilbo suddenly discovered the weak point in his plan. Most likely you saw it some time ago and have been laughing at him, but I don't suppose you would have done half as well yourselves in his place. Of course, he was not in a barrel himself,
nor was there anyone to pack him in, even if there had been a chance. It looked as if he would certainly lose his friends this time. Nearly all of them had already disappeared through the dark trapdoor, and get utterly left behind and have to stay lurking as a permanent burglar in the elf caves forever. For even if he could have escaped through the upper gates at once, he had precious small chance of ever finding the dwarves again. He did not know the way by land to the place where the barrels were collected. He wondered what on earth would happen to them without him, for he had not had time to tell the dwarves all that he had learned, or what he had meant to do, once they were out of the wood. While all these thoughts were passing through his mind, the elves, being very merry, began to sing a song round the river door. Some had already gone to haul on the ropes which pulled up the portcullis at the water gate, so as to let out the barrels as soon as they were all afloat below.
Down the swift, dark stream you go, back to lands you once did know, leave the halls and caverns deep, leave the northern mountain steep. Where the forest wide and dim stoops in shadow grey and grim, float beyond the world of trees, out into the whispering breeze, past the rushes, past the reeds, past the marshes waving weeds. Through the mist that riseth white, up from mere and pool at night, follow, follow, stars that leap up the heavens cold and steep. Turn when dawn comes over land, over rapid, over sand, south away and south away, seek the sunlight and the day. Back to pasture, back to mead, where the kine and oxen feed. Back to gardens on the hills, where the berry swells and fills. Under sunlight, under day, south away, south away. Down the swift dark stream you go, back to lands you once did know.
Now the very last barrel was being rolled to the doors. In despair, and not knowing what else to do, poor little Bilbo caught hold of it and was pushed over the edge with it. Down into the water he fell, splash, into the dark, cold water with a barrel on top of him. He came up again, spluttering and clinging to the wood like a rat. But for all his efforts, he could not scramble on top. Every time he tried, the barrel rolled round and ducked him under again. It was really empty, and floated light as a cork. Though his ears were full of water, he could hear the elves still singing in the cellar above. Then suddenly the trapdoors fell to with a boom, and their voices faded away. He was in the dark tunnel, floating in icy water, all alone, for you cannot count friends that are all packed up in barrels. Very soon a grey patch came up in the darkness ahead. He heard the creak of the water gate being hauled up, and he found that he was in the midst of a bobbing and bumping mass of casks and tubs, all pressing together to pass under the arch and get out into the open stream. He had as much as he could do to prevent himself from being hustled and battered to bits, but at last the jostling crowd began to break up and swing off, one by one, under the stone arch and away. Then he saw that it would have been no good, even if he had managed to get astride his barrel, for there was no room to spare, not even for a hobbit, between its top and the suddenly stooping roof where the gate was. Out they went under the overhanging branches of the trees on either bank. Bilbo wondered what the dwarves were feeling, and whether a lot of water was getting into their tubs.
Some of those that bobbed along by him in the gloom seemed pretty low in the water, and he guessed that these had dwarves inside. "I do hope I put the lids on tight enough," he thought, but before long he was worrying too much about himself to remember the dwarves. He managed to keep his head above the water, but he was shivering with the cold, and he wondered if he would die of it before the luck turned, and how much longer he would be able to hang on, and whether he should risk the chance of letting go and trying to swim to the bank. The luck turned all right before long. The eddying current carried several barrels close ashore at one point, and there for a while they stuck against some hidden root. Then Bilbo took the opportunity of scrambling up the side of his barrel while it was held steady against another. Up he crawled like a drowned rat, and lay on the top, spread out to keep the balance as best he could. The breeze was cold, but better than the water, and he hoped he would not suddenly roll off again when they started off once more. Before long the barrels broke free again, and turned and twisted off down the stream, and out into the main current. Then he found it quite as difficult to stick on as he had feared, but he managed it somehow, though it was miserably uncomfortable. Luckily he was very light, and the barrel was a good big one, and being rather leaky, had now shipped a small amount of water. All the same, it was like trying to ride, without bridle or stirrups, a round-bellied pony that was always thinking of rolling on the grass. In this way at last Mr. Baggins came to a place where the trees on either hand grew thinner. He could see the paler sky between them. The dark river opened suddenly wide, and there it was joined to the main water of the Forest River, flowing down in haste from the King's great doors. There was a dim sheet of water no longer overshadowed, and on its sliding surface there were dancing and broken reflections of clouds and of stars. Then the hurrying water of the Forest River swept all the company of casks and tubs away to the north bank, in which it had eaten out a wide bay. This had a shingly shore under hanging banks, and was walled at the eastern end by a little jutting cape of hard rock. On the shallow shore most of the barrels ran aground, though a few went on to bump against the stony pier.
This ends Disc 6. The Hobbit, Disc 8.
They had barely time to fly back to the tunnel, pulling and dragging in their bundles, when Smaug came hurtling from the north, licking the mountain sides with flame, beating his great wings with a noise like a roaring wind. His hot breath shriveled the grass before the door and drove in through the crack they had left and scorched them as they lay hid. Flickering fires leapt up and black rock shadows danced. Then darkness fell as he passed again. The ponies screamed with terror, burst their ropes and galloped wildly off. The dragon swooped and turned to pursue them, and was gone.
"That'll be the end of our poor beasts," said Thorin. "Nothing can escape Smaug once he sees it. Here we are, and here we shall have to stay, unless anyone fancies tramping the long open miles back to the river with Smaug on the watch." It was not a pleasant thought. They crept further down the tunnel, and there they lay and shivered, though it was warm and stuffy, until dawn came pale through the crack of the door. Every now and again, through the night, they could hear the roar of the flying dragon grow and then pass and fade as he hunted round and round the mountainsides. He guessed from the ponies and from the traces of the camps he had discovered that men had come up from the river and the lake and had scaled the mountainside from the valley where the ponies had been standing. But the door withstood his searching eye, and the little high-walled bay had kept out his fiercest flames. Long he had hunted in vain till the dawn chilled his wrath, and he went back to his golden couch to sleep.
and to gather new strength. He would not forget or forgive the theft, not if 1,000 years turned him to smouldering stone. But he could afford to wait. Slow and silent he crept back to his lair and half closed his eyes. When morning came, the terror of the dwarves grew less. They realized that dangers of this kind were inevitable in dealing with such a guardian, and that it was no good giving up their quest yet. Nor could they get away just now, as Thorin had pointed out. Their ponies were lost or killed, and they would have to wait some time before Smaug relaxed his watch sufficiently for them to dare the long way on foot. Luckily, they had saved enough of their stores to last them still for some time.
The Hobbit, Disc 7.
There were people on the lookout on the banks. They quickly poled and pushed all the barrels together into the shadows, and when they had counted them, they roped them together and left them till the morning. Poor dwarves! Bilbo was not so badly off now. He slipped from his barrel and waded ashore, and then sneaked along to some huts that he could see near the water's edge. He no longer thought twice about picking up a supper uninvited if he got the chance. He had been obliged to do it for so long, and he knew only too well what it was to be really hungry, not merely politely interested in the dainties of a well-filled larder. Also, he had caught a glimpse of a fire through the trees, and that appealed to him with his dripping and ragged clothes clinging to him cold and clammy. There is no need to tell you much of his adventures that night, for now we are drawing near the end of the eastward journey, and coming to the last and greatest adventure, so we must hurry on. Of course, helped by his magic ring, he got on very well at first, but he was given away in the end by his wet footsteps and the trail of drippings that he left wherever he went or sat. And also he began to snivel, and wherever he tried to hide, he was found out by the terrific explosions of his suppressed sneezes. Very soon there was a fine commotion in the village by the riverside, but Bilbo escaped into the woods, carrying a loaf and a leather bottle of wine and a pie that did not belong to him. The rest of the night he had to pass, wet as he was and far from afar, but the bottle helped him do that, and he actually dozed a little on some dry leaves, even though the year was getting late and the air was chilly. He woke again with a specially loud sneeze. It was already grey morning, and there was a merry racket down by the river. They were making up a raft of barrels, and the raft elves would soon be steering it off down the stream to Lake Town. Bilbo sneezed again. He was no longer dripping, but he felt cold all over. He scrambled down as fast as his stiff legs would take him, and managed, just in time, to get on to the mass of casks without being noticed in the general bustle. Luckily there was no sun at the time to cast an awkward shadow, and for a mercy he did not sneeze again for a good while. There was a mighty pushing of poles. The elves that were standing in the shallow water heaved and shoved. The barrels now, all lashed together, creaked and fretted.
"This is a heavy load," some grumbled. "They float too deep. Some of these are never empty. If they had come ashore in the daylight, we might have had a look inside," they said. "No time now," cried the raftman. "Shove off."
And off they went at last, slowly at first, until they had passed the point of rock, where other elves stood to fend them off with poles, and then quicker and quicker as they caught the main stream and went sailing away down, down towards the lake. They had escaped the dungeons of the king and were through the wood, but whether alive or dead still remains to be seen. Chapter 10.
a warm welcome. The day grew lighter and warmer as they floated along. After a while the river rounded a steep shoulder of land that came down upon their left. Under its rocky feet, like an inland cliff, the deepest stream had flowed, lapping and bubbling. Suddenly the cliff fell away. The shores sank, the trees ended. Then Bilbo saw a sight. The lands opened wide about him, filled with the waters of the river, which broke up and wandered in 100 winding courses, or halted in marshes and pools dotted with isles on every side. But still a strong water flowed on steadily through the midst. And far away, its dark head in a torn cloud, there loomed the mountain. Its nearest neighbours to the northeast and the tumbled land that joined it to them could not be seen. All alone it rose and looked across the marshes to the forest. The lonely mountain. Bilbo had come far and through many adventures to see it, and now he did not like the look of it in the least. As he listened to the talk of the raftmen, and pieced together the scraps of information they let fall, he soon realized that he was very fortunate ever to have seen it at all, even from this distance. Dreary as had been his imprisonment, and unpleasant as was his position, to say nothing of the poor dwarves underneath him, still, he had been more lucky than he had guessed. The talk was all of the trade that came and went on the waterways, and the growth of the traffic on the river, as the roads out of the east towards Mirkwood vanished or fell into disuse, and of the bickerings of the lakemen and the wood elves about the upkeep of the forest river and care of the banks. Those lands had changed much since the days when dwarves dwelt in the mountains, days which most people now remembered only as a very shadowy tradition. They had changed even in recent years, and since the last news that Gandalf had had of them. Great floods and rains had swollen the waters that flowed east, and there had been an earthquake or two, which some were inclined to attribute to the dragon, alluding to him chiefly with a curse and an ominous nod in the direction of the mountain. The marshes and bogs had spread wider and wider on either side. Paths had vanished, and many a rider and wanderer too, if they had tried to find the lost ways across. They debated long on what was to be done, but they could think of no way of getting rid of Smaug, which had always been a weak point in their plans, as Bilbo felt inclined to point out. Then, as is the nature of folk that are thoroughly perplexed, they began to grumble at the hobbit, blaming him for what had at first so pleased them, for bringing away a cup and stirring up Smaug's wrath so soon. "What else do you suppose a burglar is to do?" asked Bilbo angrily. "I was not engaged to kill dragons, that is warrior's work, but to steal treasure. I made the best beginning I could. Did you expect me to trot back with a whole horde of thrall on my back? If there's any grumbling to be done, I think I might have a say. You ought to have brought 500 burglars, not one. I'm sure it reflects great credit on your grandfather, but you cannot pretend that you ever made the vast extent of his wealth clear to me. I should want hundreds of years to bring it all up, if I was 50 times as big, and Smaug as tame as a rabbit." After that, of course, the dwarves begged his pardon. "What then do you propose we should do, Mr. Baggins?" asked Thorin politely.
"I have no idea at the moment, if you mean about removing the treasure. That obviously depends entirely on some new turn of luck and the getting rid of Smaug. Getting rid of dragons is not at all in my line, but I'll do my best to think about it. Personally, I have no hopes at all, and wish I was safe back at home."
"Never mind that for the moment. What are we to do now, today?"
"Well, if you really want my advice, I should say we can do nothing but stay where we are. By day we can no doubt creep out safely enough to take the air. Perhaps before long...